Chapter 10, Cannonball Olympics. When they arrived at Galileo's humble lodgings, Galileo said to Dee Dee, "Can you take the test equipment to the launch tower? We will meet you there shortly. No offence." The little Dee Dee went off in an obedient huff. Just as they were entering the house, Galileo pulled Sean up by the arm. "Shh! Can you feel that?"
"No, what?" said Sean.
"Can't you feel the earth spinning? What shape is it exactly? A pizza? If so, it should be expanding at its edges. That is the only possible explanation for why, no matter how far we sail or travel, we can never reach the edges of the world." Galileo let Sean ponder that for a moment before saying, "Only kidding. I play these tricks on my students all the time. Trouble is, they take me seriously." As they went in, Sean said, "You know, as crazy as that sounds, in my time scientists are still stuck on the same question, only not about the Earth, but about the shape of the universe. Is it a pizza or a balloon? Will it expand forever?" Galileo led Sean into his extremely homely mess. Like Leonardo's workshop, there were wooden models everywhere, mathematical half-dones scattered over the tables, and piles of order forms for a military compass he had invented, made himself, and was catalogue-selling. After Galileo had conjured them up an excellent dinner, he gave his answer. "It seems to me that a rational approach to explaining the fundamentals of the universe would be towards an ever simpler model. A kind of catch-all gut feeling I have is that our model of five elements is too complex, and that fundamentally there should be only three. Who knows, perhaps a grandly unified theory may arise one day that reduces it all to one element." Sean shook his head. "I'm sorry to tell you this, but the latest count is over 100 elements, and people of my time are still trying to find the commonality between them all." Galileo was evidently disappointed. "So, in addition to still haggling about the shape of the universe, in the future the grand unified theory is still just..."
"Yes, a GUT gut feeling."
The second disappointment about the future was obviously a blow to Galileo. In a bit of a funk, he began to play with one of his toys. This was a long, narrow board set at an inclination. On it were two grooves, in which balls of different sizes and weights could be rolled. No matter which balls were chosen, if released simultaneously, they would arrive at the bottom of the slope together. Sean watched him for a while. "I built this model racetrack to give my younger brother as a Christmas present," explained Galileo. "But it doesn't seem to work properly. The balls always arrive together. I have tried everything to fix it, polishing one of the balls, using hollow or solid ones, lead versus cork, even cheating by pushing one slightly. But it's no good. They always arrive together." "So, what do you conclude?" asked Sean, recognizing this kiddie's toy as one of the greatest experiments in the history of science, that balls and a feather are locked together. Galileo nodded wisely and said, "That the equipment is broken. It is rubbish."
"No, I mean, what do you conclude about gravity?" Sean asked.
Galileo went to a football-sized glass model of Luca Pacioli's rompicuboctahedron he had hanging, half-filled with water as a vase, and span it. Now Sean could see that the eight squares around the middle had engravings of the Vitruvian man, and spinning the shape made him dance in a brief flicker animation sequence. There was no denying that erotic geometry, with its divine proportions, or golden ratio, is a cornerstone of the Renaissance.
"Master Galileo, you said you had something to show me," said Sean, not knowing what else to say.
"Yes, it is this." From his sleeve, Galileo produced the digital watch.
"I knew you had it," exclaimed Sean happily, taking the watch and admiring it still as new appearance. "But where did you find it?"
"Rather a long story." "Ever heard of a man, an oracle, called Our Lady?"
"Never. Strange name for a guy."
"That wasn't his only problem. You may know him under his syndicated trademark, Nostradamus. When he was young, Nostradamus came up with a rather novel business model. He would first send out anonymous messages of doom and gloom in enigmatic quatrains, four-line poems, designed to up the value of his mood booster greeting cards. As with my practical joke teaching method, the worst thing that can happen is people taking you seriously."
"Sorry, but I don't see what that has got to do with the watch."
What if I were to tell you that Leonardo da Vinci knew Nostradamus?
Leonardo?
They met at a future-guessing festival, one of those Iron Man events where people drink themselves so stupid they begin to see visions. Nostradamus was only a teenager, but it seems he managed to get Leonardo to illustrate his first line of greeting cards. On Nostradamus's death straw, a publisher gained the rights to bring out a commemorative series of these cards. They were medical advice cards, published under the unlikely title of Mr. Our Lady Cures Your Blockage, sold with a gift pack of remedial cures for ailments of the juices. You know how these quacks work. Take a quatrain after meals and call in on me in the morning. And they still appear in French as Les Prophéties de Monsieur Nostradamus.
Galileo began to rummage for something in various piles of notes and dried animal parts.
It is an online service.
Online? Cried Sean.
Yes. You append the card on a line above the door to your privy. Just a little ditty about how to avoid the plague, which leech is recommended for what. Yet another bleeding cure this, bleeding cure that. The very latest in medical science. There's also a desktop version which comes with a screensaver.
Why did he call himself Our Lady?
Well, it was Leonardo's idea. An intentional allusion to Mona Lisa. Madonna Lisa was doing really well in the miniatures market in France, so they used the medical advice trademark of My Lady to keep the Italian flavour. A very successful brand. In fact, we still call illnesses maladies or maladies.
Galileo hung a card up on a string.
I received this little ditty for my 21 1/2th birthday.
Sean came over and read the glitzy script. Supra capitulum armarium rompius, tenet linguam caelestium, ubi claudit lacus cerasus, in capsula Madridum realum.
What does that teach you? Asked Galileo.
That Nostradamus was rubbish at Latin?
What do you expect from a guy with a name which means Our Lady? Anyway, he usually wrote in French, except for the foreign festivities card trade.
So what does it mean?
Translated, you get, a rompy cupboard head-on holds the celestial tongue where the cherry lake locks a ball for foot in a box. So duly I went to the cherry lake, which I took to mean Lago Ceresio, on the shores of which lies Lucano. After searching for 3 days, I found the only house that matches that description. The main portal bears an inscription above it, 3 letters which make up Leonardo's logo, A-V-O, meaning Amor Vincit Omnes, love conquers all.
Amor, cried Sean.
Ring anything up a bell tower?
Certainly does. Do you think Leo is trying to tell us something?
Oh, definitely. He has left a whole trail of clues.
Some light was cautiously dawning for Sean. Is that why Leo went to France?
Could be. He gave Nostradamus a clue as to how to find the Spici Celesti, the mythical language of the gods.
Galileo picked up the watch, embodied in an artifact known as the Sangreal. So you deciphered the quatrain and found the watch inside the house?
Yes.
But the house?
Oh, don't worry, Galileo reassured him. It is sealed by the Hexagogo still. Leonardo made sure Cesare Borgia and his later incarnations could never get in.
So if Cespuglio couldn't get in, how could you?
By studying the geometry of Pacioli, who was a keen student of Vitruvius. He and Leonardo returned and finished the house, adding more eggs to seal it. They guessed the watch would return one day, so they left clues and a single way in, if you can work out where.
Which, of course, you could. Good old Luca and Leo, cried Sean happily.
So I found the watch as they wanted and brought it here, and waited for you, finished Galileo.
He looked sad suddenly.
Now I am afraid my usefulness has ended.
Maestro Galileo, don't be like that. I promise you, you will go down in history.
That's what my teacher told me. If you don't study harder, he said, you will go down in history. You're just trying to cheer me up. It's no use. It is already the modern world of which they spoke. There's a brand new calendar. What else could there be to learn?
Lots and lots of things. Let's start here. What is all this stuff? Sean pointed at the shelves and tables covered in an incredible variety of things. It reminded him of Archimedes and Leonardo's, and Nonna's for that matter, workshops.
Oh, little nothings I amuse myself with. Trying to get something to work finally so I can convince the university to give me a real job. They say I don't understand the basics. That's why I waste my time experimenting, they say. Only because I haven't grasped the fundamental truths yet. Maybe they are right. It was all written in Aristotle's works 2,000 years ago. Who am I to think I can change anything?
There was another ancient Greek, well, more old than ancient, who challenged Aristotle, Archimedes. Galileo looked pleased and shocked at the same time. He went to the door and window to ensure no one was there, before returning to whisper,
"I'm a great fan of Archimedes."
Galileo indicated a long shelf holding just two small books.
"I have everything ever written about him, and a full set of Who's Who in the Ancient World tobacco cards. There is a rumour that his greatest work has been mislaid due to a classification error in some library in the Middle East. But of course we cannot go there because of the no hasta la vista restrictions, which means I don't have a visa.
I know Archimedes better than you can possibly imagine, and I can promise you he felt just as rejected and misunderstood as you do.
And he succeeded in the end?
Well, no, they killed him, but you will be different. When Galileo remained in a funk, Sean tried, "What were you doing in the cathedral?" This bucked him up as intended.
"Proving one of my theories, that a pendulum of a certain length will swing with the same time period between swing ends, no matter how heavy the object suspended. Watch."
He had a rig with two strings of equal lengths attached. One had a heavy metal ball, the other a cork. "Observe." He released them. They swang in perfect harmony.
"The same thing happened when you landed on the chandelier. When you came down, the chandelier continued to swing with the same period, despite the change in weight."
"That's brilliant, Maestro Galileo. And what's that over there?" asked Sean, indicating a tub of water over which hung a balance. On one side was a piece of metal, fashioned roughly into the form of a crown. On the other was a shapeless lump.
"I'm recreating Archimedes' greatest eureka moment. It uses density and buoyancy in water to measure impurities in metal. The Duke's Department of Coinage doesn't like it for some reason. I call it the little balance."
"And the big balance?" asked Sean.
"That happens on the tower."
Galileo slapped his copious forehead.
"Oh, I've forgotten Didi. He is waiting for us up the tower."
"Why?"
"I'll explain on the way."
Galileo took the watch and inexplicably strapped it onto a large apple. He then rigged a small and complicated device over the watch, which involved some sort of lever on its buttons. He positioned a silver coin so it rested on the stop-start button before he put the assembly carefully in his pocket.
"Can you pocket that cannonball?" he said to Sean, and led the way out the door and back up the road to the Leaning Tower.
The tower stood over the rooftops like a beacon as they made their way to it.
"Galileo, why is the tower leaning?"
gasped Sean as he ran alongside, struggling with the heavy ball.
"A spelling mistake. The city had commissioned a tower of learning."
"So why am I carrying this heavy ball?" asked Sean, his arms aching.
"I have decided to enter this year's Cannonball Olympics. If I can win, the mathematics chair will be mine for sure. The tower is a perfect launching pad. It leans over so the balls fall clear. We have races to see whose cannonball will land first. The heavier the better, obviously."
"But you saw from your brother's game that all bodies fall at the same rate of acceleration."
"What actually happens does not change what is written in the game's manual."
"So what are the results of the races?" asked Sean.
"So far in every race, the church favourite has won."
"How can they always win?"
"Well, they say they have the best engineers to optimize the descendancy control. That and the fact that they also supply the judges. Some cynics say the results are related to the fact that the church also run the gambling stalls. Who knows?
I thought sport was supposed to involve fair play."
"This is Italy.
What's it like in your day?
It's still Italy.
But Galileo, if you dropped a wooden ball of the same size, it would fall just as fast.
Ah, well, I see a couple of problems there. First of all, there's no such thing as a wooden cannonball. Wouldn't be much use, would it? And secondly, it is against the rules. That's fair enough. All sports must have rules.
But this is science, objected Sean as they began the ascent of the 294 steps of the tower.
Ah, there's the technicality, you see. The church very cleverly reclassified cannonball dropping from science to sport, so it falls under the recreation licensing jurisdiction.
In this way, they can determine how it is to be done, and anyone trying anything else is disqualified. They were near the top of the tower. They edged around the huge bell in the dark chamber, and then proceeded up the last marble steps to the ledge, jutting by virtue of the lean over the grass lawn, a sickening 56 meters below them.
"Where is Didi? He should be here," complained Galileo, gazing back down the stairs into the dark of the floor below them.
Somebody flicked a switch. This is to say, they used a branch to whip a servant, to light a lantern, to plunge the chamber into a less gloomy shade of black. What Sean saw coming up the steps behind them froze the more crucial of his cerebral hemispheres. These were the feared watchhammer troops, bearing symbols of a breaking watch and a hammerhead. From a distance, the combination looked uncannily like a beaker, with Sangre Al written beneath it. At their head was a cardinal.
"So we meet again, Sean Saint-Pierre, and an old friend too."
The procession had reached the upper landing. The cardinal stepped aside, which is not usually advised on a narrow platform, to reveal a little someone being held by a group of the white-cloaked and heavily armoured watchhammer troops.
"Didi!
Oh, come now, Sean. Surely you recognise your old friend from Syracuse?"
"Sean, it's me, Elf," said the little man,
pinioned between the guards.
"Elf!"
cried Sean.
"But what are you doing here?"
"Doing as Powell suggested, trying to inspire Galileo to drop things from the tower."
"What is that supposed to prove?"
asked Sean, not giving in to the temptation to ask where Pau and Jenny were.
"Something about gravity, isn't it?"
replied Elf.
"Didn't Pau tell you?"
"Well, you may have skipped over some of the details." "So, what do you want, Cespuglio?" challenged Sean, bravely turning on the cardinal. Cespuglio laughed his cruel laugh.
"Ha! Why don't you enlighten us, Galileo?"
"Yes, of course."
And Galileo lit his lamp.
"No, I mean tell us about your theory of cannonball dropping."
After I realized that since the scriptures had been irrevocably declared right, there must be something wrong with reality, I determined that the only way to win the competition was to measure the actual time a body takes to fall. With the church cheating as the judges, I needed proof, and this,"
he pulled out the apple and the watch,
"would provide that."
Cespuglio's eyes lit up at the sight of the watch, and the watchhammer troops shuffled, their beady red eyes signalling tones of expectation. Galileo continued, "By tying the watch around an object about the same size and shape as a cannonball, but very different Archimedean densiticity, such as this apple, and dropping it, I could get a measurement of the time it takes to traverse the 56 meters to the ground. By fitting the watch to the apple in this way, the impact will cause this lever to push this coin onto this button, and the watch will stop its count. Then I repeat the experiment with the cannonball, and then I have the two times, and we can determine the true winner. Incidentally, by measuring the falling times from different levels of the tower, I have discovered an interesting fact. The objects do not fall at even speeds, but appear to accelerate, and this acceleration may be described mathematically, allowing me to predict how long it will take any object to fall any height. This may lead one day to a general description of the motion of the bodies, a small drop for an apple, but a giant leap for mankind."
"Speaky celesti!" cried Sean.
Cespuglio shook his head. "But Galileo, the church wins every time, does it not?"
"So far, yes. I've had no luck in getting my ideas approved by the various departments."
"Which departments?" asked Sean.
For example, when I attempted to revive an old idea that the stuff of the world is made up of very small pieces, called in ancient Greece the unlikely word atom. Why atom? Why not a Dick or a Harry? Mocked Gespulio. I guess it was the first name that came to them, was Galileo's lame answer. Now tell them how I blocked your Copernican system, chided Gespulio. The theory that the sun is the centre of the universe was banned for reasons of national security, since there would otherwise surely be widespread panic at the thought of the earth falling towards the sun.
National security is one of my favourite excuses, cherished Gespulio. Galileo, the watch, please. Galileo held the watch, still wrapped around the apple, and looked at it sadly.
Couldn't I just do one last experiment before you destroy it?
To Sean's lasting surprise, Gespulio indulged him.
All right, just one.
While Galileo was fumbling with the timing trigger mechanism, Gespulio turned to Elf. And now, little man, you can join your two friends. He opened a small wooden chest one of the Watchhammer troops was holding, and took out the same iron crown that Cesare Borgia had been wearing. He played with it for a few moments, relishing its power over the minds of men, before he lowered it ceremoniously onto Elf's head. In a last desperate bid, Elf broke one arm free from the invertebrate guards holding him. He reached into his pocket to pull out a time egg, and lifted his arm to throw the small piece of polished rock at his feet. But the crown had begun to glimmer and do its parents' guidance only thing, just as the helmet had done with Stinto and Syracuse. As a result, Elf's host took back the control of his body with a jolt, causing the hand to release the egg in mid-swing, sending it flying over Sean's head to do a teasingly slow parabola up and over the tower's balustrade. Sean instinctively lunged for it, and so doing caught Galileo's hand holding the apple with the watch strapped around it. The next thing Sean knew, he was falling, target Earth, the egg and the apple rotating just out of his reach beneath him. They hit the ground in exactly the same formation. Galileo, who had been watching from above, saw this and said, "Now, that is interesting."